Hello everyone. I'm Elaine Brooke. I'm director of the Gaia Partnership. I'm here to introduce Jonathan Porritt. Gaia Partnership helps people to enjoy making their lifestyles or their businesses more environmentally friendly, so we're delighted to be able to invite Jonathan here. I'd like to thank our co-sponsors, Bulmers, who are also greening up their business, and Classic FM for helping us to publicise not only this event, but the Gaia exhibition, which is full of information on how to live a more planet-friendly lifestyle. I've been asked to mention that there will be a collection for the Sri Lanka appeal after you exit the tent. And I also need to mention that Jonathan will be signing copies of his book, Capitalism as If the World Matters, at the book tent after the talk. And immediately after that, at 7:10, there will be a small group discussion session with Jonathan at the Gaia exhibition, which is just opposite Café Direct. So if you didn't get your question answered during the main session, then come along. It's on a first-come, first-served basis. And fire your questions at Jonathan then. We are, as I mentioned, absolutely delighted to be able to invite Jonathan here. He has been the voice of sustainability for so many years in this country, first of all with Friends of the Earth, then the Green Party, and more recently with Forum for the Future and as chair of the Sustainability Commission. So please welcome Jonathan Porritt.
Thank you. Well, it's very nice to be here. I haven't been back to Hay for quite a long time, so it's a real privilege to be in front of such an audience as this, all warmed up as you are, of course, by Al Gore, no less, who has given us his vision of what's going to happen to the world if we don't get this climate change challenge sorted out. Now, obviously, Al Gore wasn't enough for the Hay Festival, so they then gave me two riders of the apocalypse to deal with, climate change and peak oil. That was in case any of you had any vestige of optimism left over at all. I am essentially here to crush it, as far as I can tell, and send you out into the world even more depressed than you were by the time you arrived. Well, I'm going to try and defy your expectations on that score, because I'm going to talk briefly about both climate change and this thing called peak oil, which I'll explain a bit. But I really want to try and focus my comments about the more positive things that might happen, and do it in what is probably going to be a slightly mad way, but nonetheless, let's go with it. On the climate change stuff, I really want to be pretty brief. I don't imagine that many of you here in an audience such as this are any longer in any doubt as to either the urgency or the severity of the climate change challenge. You'd have to be, as I describe it, living off planet still to be immune to that set of understandings. And now, of course, David Attenborough, after 10 years of assiduously sitting on the fence, has fallen off it the right side, I'm happy to say. There are one or two other complete nutters on the other side. Fallen off it on the right side and has come out with an extremely powerful and very welcome statement saying that really there should be no doubt left in the minds of anybody, in business, in government, amongst citizens like us, there just should be no doubt left at all. So in a way, the ranks of those who are still trying to tell us that this is not serious and not an issue is thinning, diminishing all the time. I half expect that the next convert to the cause will be no less an expert than Jeremy Clarkson himself. I don't know where he will choose to have his epiphany, his moment of truth, but I am looking forward to it when it comes, because it will be well worth it at that point. I'm not allowed to be any ruder than that today because I've been ticked off by the Sustainable Development Commission for getting into personal abuse, which of course is something I hardly ever do. Anyway, that's all to the good. We know where we are now. We understand this. But maybe people don't quite read the science in the way that they need to read it. And I just want to remind you how we should be reading it, because it is important not just to understand what the science now tells us, but what the implications of what the science now tells us really are. So the first thing is this, that everything is moving a great deal faster than they thought it was going to be moving even 2 years ago. And when you talk to scientists in the science community, they will tell you that the last 2 years have been deeply shocking in terms of the volume and the authority of the data that has come forward about a number of different climate phenomena. Secondly, you shouldn't think about climate change as a gradually unfolding set of phenomena, all gradually increasing in our midst. The climate record, the historical climate record, tells us very carefully, very clearly, that this is as much about sharp discontinuities in patterns of climate as about gently rising changes and curves. And we still don't internalize that in our own mind. Thirdly, we should be thinking about systems and not symptoms. We're still focused very much on individual symptoms. We're focused on the permafrost. We're focused on disappearing sea ice or melting glaciers or increased intensity of hurricanes. We keep looking at these individual phenomena, epiphenomena, and what we're not looking at is the big system stuff. And this is where Al Gore has really introduced a very important note, reminding us that we are just one tiny, tiny part of this vast, complex system, which we are still causing difficulties to at our peril. And lastly, the thing that we haven't yet understood is that if you read the science in the way it now needs to be read, there is no room left for anybody who thinks that this means anything other than a radical break with the way in which we create and distribute wealth in the world today. I still hear people talk about climate change as something which can be managed within the dominant orthodox economic paradigm. I don't believe that. I just don't believe that that is the case. I don't see how we're going to be able to manipulate those conventional aspects of a growth-bound, consumer-driven economy and cope with climate change in the way that we actually need to. And to a certain extent, that's what my book, Capitalism as If the World Matters, has really tried to address, which is to stop people thinking there's a nice, gentle fix inside the system, because there almost certainly isn't. So, do we have enough time to deal with this? Al Gore will persuade his audiences that we do. Anyone who's going to go and listen to Jim Lovelock here at the festival will try and persuade you that we don't. Jim Lovelock has come to the conclusion it is already too late, possibly even 30 to 40 years too late, which is a shame since none of us actually knew about climate change until about 30 years ago. Very difficult to deal with this issue if you think it's too late to do anything about it. How do you empower people? How do you give people a sense of agency, a sense that there really is a set of actions, individual, communal, national, global, that we can take if people are telling us, actually, it doesn't really matter what you do because it's all too late anyway? Now, I am definitely not in the all too late anyway category. But I am in that group of people who say that paradoxically, we need the pain of climate change to come through fast and furiously in as short a time as possible. Because we need to shock this still complacent, inert system into a state of radical response rather than grudging incrementalism, which is what we have today. So I found myself somewhat to my horror, my sort of moral horror, when I was asked to explain what that meant. I said, well, the easiest way to explain it is what we really need is a hurricane season like last year's for the next 3 years, and each one worse than the year before. We need 2 Katrinas this year, 3 next year, and 4 the year after. And more than anything else, that will galvanize the key agent of change, potential agent of change, namely America, to start thinking about this very differently. We do live in a weird world where the only way to get change is to wish down on people utter calamity and misery. It is a very strange thing to have to own up to. So that's climate change in a whirlwind, obviously. The second issue that I'm required to deal with is related in many respects, but quite different in other respects, and that's the phenomenon or the debate known as the peak oil debate. At one level, very simple. People are asking the question, in which year will we take more oil and gas out of the surface of the earth than in any preceding year and in any year after that? So what is the year when we literally take more of that precious asset, our oil and gas supplies, out than in any other year? Because obviously from that point on, you're into a very different set of resource depletion issues. As we all know, from that point on, prices will rise and so on and so forth. It's a very lively debate, again, I'm happy to say. It's been a very muted debate over the last 20 years, but recently, the last 3 to 4 years, it's become a much, much bigger debate than it used to be before. And Jeremy Leggett was here at the festival talking about this because he's one of the most articulate exponents of the idea of an early peaking period, oil and gas peaking in 2008, 2009, or something like that. Lined up against him, of course, is a whole battery of very bright economists. I only put that word in that sort of intonation because you all know economists do find it difficult to find the real world, even when you shove it up their noses. It is tricky. Lined up against people like Jeremy and a bunch of dissident geologists are all these economists who say, this is rubbish. There's no problem about that. The laws of supply and demand will kick in. As soon as the price of oil reaches where we are now, roughly $70 a barrel, then everybody will begin to think about this asset differently. They'll begin to use it differently. Demand will diminish, and that will allow supply to kick in and meet demand without any problem. The arch exponents of this view are our colleagues in the oil industry, particularly in BP, interestingly enough, usually a very progressive, relatively progressive protagonist in this debate. BP regularly tells its shareholders and anybody else who wants to listen that there will be no problem until about 2030. So you've got 2008 on the one hand, 2030 on the other. That's a big difference. It is very hard to read this one, and to be absolutely honest, I don't know what the answer is. I listen to Jeremy and I'm sort of impressed, and I listen to BP and I'm not quite so impressed, but still worrying about the doubts that they raise in my mind. And then you find out one or two key issues, like how much oil is there left in the Saudi Arabian oil fields? Because they are still the world's largest producer. They are known as the swing producer because they can either increase or decrease extraction and production in order to meet higher or lower demand. And the truth is, nobody knows. Well, nobody outside of Saudi Arabia knows how much oil is left in those Saudi Arabian reserves. At the upper level is an estimate of 268 billion barrels of oil. That's the estimate offered by the Saudi Arabian government. At the lower end is an estimate of 78 billion barrels of oil, offered by an independent expert who's been a lot in Saudi Arabia looking at the industry and who feels that most of this projection stuff from the government itself is, if not a direct lie, then pretty fictional. Between 268 billion barrels on the one hand, 78 billion barrels on the other, the margin for error is huge. So we really don't know the answer to the question. But what we do know is the direction we're going in. If you look at the demand curves, particularly demand in China and India and other developing countries, those demand curves are incredibly vibrant and dynamic. And in my opinion, those demand curves will make it increasingly difficult for the oil and gas industry to provide enough supplies to keep that in balance. Now that's veering towards the pessimism bit there. The optimists say, well, look, you know, don't panic. There are lots of other supplies of fossil fuels that we can draw down on. We can take more oil out of these deep sea deposits than we've been able to do up until now. Extraction technology is improving all the time. We can get more and more out than we were ever able to do before. If we run out of that, don't worry. We can bring in these unconventional supplies of oil. And for those of you who were reading The Guardian today, and I presume here at Hay, obviously, it is the natural newspaper to be reading, you will have seen a fascinating full-page article about Shell's latest venture in Canada, seeking to accelerate its exploitation of the Athabasca tar sands, this enormous, vast, potentially vast resource of oil trapped up in sand. Very difficult to get out, but potentially a huge asset, potentially even bigger than Saudi Arabia's oil reserves. But the article is great because it says, well, possibly. But when you look at the amount of energy that you need to get a barrel of oil out of those tar sands, you suddenly begin to realize that depletion rates, carbon emissions, are in a very intricate dance now. And if we want to increase our use of fossil fuels, unfortunately, we have to increase the energy consumption required to deliver the same volume of energy. We're heading towards the point of what is known as a zero-sum game. Imagine the day where you need more than a barrel of oil to get a barrel of oil equivalent out of the ground. That would be a pretty odd world to live in, wouldn't it? We're not far off it. So, those are my two horse riders of the apocalypse, if you like. They're pretty serious. They do posit a challenge to conventional political and economic thinking, which to me is dramatic. I remain pretty depressed at the quality of political discourse that arises out of an understanding of these two issues. Even as climate change is, as it were, owned by politicians around the world, and we have got more leadership on that now, don't underestimate that. Even in America, the sort of bastion of redneck contrarian views on climate change, even in America, if you look at what's going on in the states, in the cities, in big companies, in public opinion, in terms of public opinion, you'll see very marked shifts of view about climate change. And we're almost to the point where George Bush is now completely isolated on Capitol Hill in this perverse and utterly destructive opinion and attitude towards climate change. Him, of course, and the redoubtable Lee Raymond, former chief executive of ExxonMobil, as he has now moved on with his $400 million check in his pocket, his payoff from ExxonMobil. Someone did shock me. I am interested in corporate excess, but someone did succeed in shocking even me when they told me that over the 13 years that Lee Raymond had been chief executive of ExxonMobil, he had earned $682 million. In salary alone. Forget the pension payoff, okay? $682 million. It's sort of like a one-man billionaire, almost, which is pretty startling. So we shouldn't underestimate the political understanding of this, but the political will that comes off the back of that is still completely inadequate. On peak oil, the debate is very poor. There's no quality debate about that at all. You don't hear politicians really discussing this. No one really wants to confront the reality of what would happen in our lives if we were suddenly deprived of access to relatively cheap oil and gas. Because think it through. Which bit of your life, and you're not exactly a representative audience of humankind, okay, but which bit of your life is not dependent on access to fossil fuels in that way, whether you talk about industry or farming or services, whatever it might be? We have been able to grow this extraordinary bubble of industrial civilization since the Second World War largely on the back of cheap fossil fuels. Strip out the fossil fuels, or the cheap fossil fuels, and life begins to look very different indeed. So no shortage of reasons to be pretty gloomy about all that, and it would be quite wrong to stand here in front of you and pretend that there was a set of Pollyanna-ish fixes that we could just deploy without too much effort, and hey presto, suddenly the world would be set to rights, because that is not going to happen. And one of the reasons it's not going to happen is because not enough people are as yet persuaded that a very different way of life in a carbon-constrained, oil-scarce world, they are not persuaded that their lives would be better in that world than the lives they have today. I think we have to take that on the chin in the environment movement. Historically, we've been very good at demonstrating why it is that this system cannot continue indefinitely into the future. We've been very good at identifying, analysing, surfacing the costs of this system in terms of damage to the environment, damage to people's lives and so on. That's something that the environment movement can take a huge amount of credit for having done very successfully over 30 years.
But where we have not succeeded
is in persuading enough people that coming into a different way of life, into a different way of creating and distributing wealth, wouldn't just be better for the planet, but would be better for us. Wouldn't just be better for future generations, which is our usual rhetoric, but which would be better for this generation, people today. And as someone who stood on many, many occasions as a candidate for the Green Party, I did learn the phenomenon very quickly of people when you tried the rhetoric of this is all about future generations, our children, and our children's children, our children's children's children. They'd sort of look you in the eye and say in one form or another, fine, but what has the future ever done for me? And what is the Green Party going to do for me now? And if you're not going to be able to persuade me that you've got something to offer me now in my life, please do not expect me to vote for notional potential benefits for my children at some distant stage in the future. So let's just go into a different space, just for the last 10 minutes, because I want to leave plenty of time for Q&A. Just for a moment, imagine a slightly strange world. I don't know how far away this world is going to be. It depends how quickly the planet bites back. It depends how quickly climate change forces a political process that isn't available to us at the moment. But imagine this world in which oil is trading on the global markets at $100 a barrel as a regular. Okay, so it might go up a bit and down a bit, but the average annual price is $100 a barrel. And at the same time, carbon is trading on a global carbon trading scheme at, say, 100 euros a ton within Europe, or whatever it might be, 50, 60, 70 dollars a ton. Okay, so huge new economic variables to factor in. $100 a barrel and 60, 70 dollars for a ton of carbon. Now, I can assure you that every single calculation you might want to make about your life with those two factors suddenly part of it would be changed dramatically. Absolutely dramatically. Nothing would look the same. For one thing, carbon would become as important a currency, a metric, as money. And people who lived carbon-intensive lives, the sort of gas-guzzler-type lives, as it were, would find themselves in a very different world from people who lived carbon-responsible lives, carbon-lean lives, whose lifestyle did not cause huge amounts of carbon to be emitted, directly or indirectly. First time in history, as far as I can see it, where the cyclist bites back, where we are able, where I personally am able, to sell my personal carbon quota to Jeremy Clarkson. This is a moment I am just relishing. I just hope neither of us are dead before that point arrives. Because, boy, do I want to get him to pay a premium. So just think through this for a moment, okay? I'm not going to go into the great details about this, but imagine a world, oil at $100 a barrel and carbon pretty damn expensive as well, and then begin to play with some ideas. What's the first thing that happens? Well, the first thing that happens is distance suddenly becomes a reality again in our lives. Because of the wonders of modern civilization, because of access to cheap fossil fuels, distance has become largely irrelevant. What was once an astonishing luxury, namely flying over to France, as it were, is now a standard, and suddenly we have cheap fares for long-haul flights. I saw the latest cheap fare long-haul to New Zealand advertised the other day, as if they were meant to go out there for a couple of days and fly back again. So distance has shrunk and shrunk. It's become increasingly less material to people as they plan their personal budgets and their own way of life. So distance will become a big thing again. We won't just travel, because we can travel. We won't just use the car, because we've got the car, and it's there, and we might as well use it because we paid a lot for it. We will start thinking about how to use public transport. We will start thinking about walking those short distances. We will start thinking about bicycling. That in itself will begin to change some quite interesting aspects of our current lives. One of the problems we face today is devastatingly inactive lifestyles for very large parts of the population, causing patterns of ill health, summarized, of course, in the obesity debate today. But suddenly we would begin to see that instead of obesity becoming a standard, And if you've seen the figures for childhood obesity, you'll know what I mean. More and more people would start living healthier lives. It would become accepted practice that children could again walk and cycle to school. Not necessarily in rural areas, because that's often pretty difficult, but in urban areas, in towns. We would rediscover the business of enabling kids to get to school without having to get in the car. In terms of farming, we'd begin to see a renaissance of local production. Local production for local markets, local communities, whatever it might be. We'd not only see that, we'd see farmers taking advantage of the need for alternative fuels to come forward, the use of biofuels of one sort or another, the use of biomass to generate the energy that we need that we can't any longer get from fossil fuels. We'd see the efforts of companies like Bulmers, and I didn't know I was actually being sponsored by Bulmers, and it's quite interesting suddenly to be sponsored by a company that you didn't know was sponsoring you, but I am really delighted to be sponsored by Bulmers here today, because they're a company that Forum for the Future has worked with for 8 years now, and they are a very innovative company when it comes to thinking through both these big sustainability issues and responsibilities for the community. It's not been the easiest relationship in terms of its role in Hereford, where obviously when they were taken over by a much bigger company, there was a considerable loss of jobs in Hereford, with considerable damage to the local economy. But they've really dealt with that in a responsible way. They've also been responsible for trying to remind people of Herefordshire and the power of Herefordshire as a county, doing a lot to keep apple orchards as vibrant as they need to be. So all of these economic relationships would begin to change. I was joking about my carbon budget, but you imagine a world in which those who had really very simple lives were suddenly carbon rich in terms of what they could buy with their carbon credits. And then extrapolate out from that locally to what would happen on a global basis, where poor countries, not responsible for emitting much carbon, were able to sell their carbon credits to very rich countries. We'd see a form of distribution in the global economy which would be absolutely revolutionary, one of the most effective ways of changing the balance of power between rich and poor in the world today. Better yet, we would unleash this astonishing thing that we hold between our ears here, the human brain. It always astonishes me that so tiny a percentage of the human genius is currently devoted to the task of learning to live sustainably on this planet. It's a minute fraction. A vast, great stretch of the human genius is devoted to doing everything else that is completely unsustainable and often morally reprehensible, and a minute fraction at the moment is devoted to the sustainability challenge. Imagine a world in which 100% of that potential was driven towards that goal. I had a tiny, wonderful example of this. China, big story, we'll no doubt get onto that later, facing massive problems in terms of water shortages. China's not messing around about this. What did they do? Sent huge delegations to three countries, California, Israel, and Australia, to learn about water-efficient techniques in the domestic scene, in agriculture, in industry. They came back to China. They set up a high-level council. They're now driving a pattern of investment in water efficiency, which I bet you now will make China the world leader in water efficiency technologies in 5 years' time. Why? Because they've got to do it. They've got 1.3 billion people desperate for better lives who can't find enough water. And do they think they can do it? Yes, if you talk to them. Why? Because they think they can generate the same material standard of living for 1/50th of current water consumption. 1/50th. So you start to play around with this stuff. Suddenly the human brain is doing something intelligent for a change. It's working out how to live on its planet as if we wanted to carry on living here instead of devising increasingly insane methods to accelerate our demise. This will bring forward technologies of a speed and rate that I don't believe people really understand. I know there are some people in the Green Movement who hate this technological enthusiasm, who feel deeply depressed when they hear people like me getting enthusiastic about technology. But if you're not enthusiastic about technology, you're pretty much finished when it comes to optimism. Because there's no optimistic solution to 6 billion people trying to live on this planet without a massive technological driver. No solution available at all. So don't get snooty about technology. Get the system to start using technology in the way that we need.
Then say the use of these technologies at the local level in our own homes, where we're becoming more and more energy self-sufficient, using microgeneration, small-scale generating technologies, massively increased efficiency in our use of energy. That would give birth again to a sense of personal responsibility for our role on this planet. Imagine if that personal responsibility didn't start too late in life to make much of a difference, but started in our schools, so that every single young person leaving school in this country left with a deeply embedded understanding of sustainability and with a knowledge of how to lead a sustainable life, which would mean every single school would have to be an exemplar of what sustainable living means on energy, waste, food, the whole bit. Not so far away, incidentally. Haven't said much nice about government yet today. They do occasionally do the odd good thing, and they are about to bring forward an interesting and quite ambitious program called Building Schools for the Future, where we will begin to see some dramatic changes. Imagine then that personal responsibility spilled over into increased community cohesion, people rediscovering the sense of community instead of leading these atomized, disaggregated, hatefully individualized lives which we lead now, increasingly stuck in front of the box or the screen or whatever else it might be. Imagine we began to rediscover a sense of community through this, that we began to be involved in more community schemes around recycling, waste management, around energy generation, around food production and distribution. Imagine that then led on to a greater sense of how communities could start to create wealth for themselves within their own geographical boundaries. Imagine all of that led to a situation in which energy started to get cheaper instead of more expensive, creating all sorts of liberations for people who at the moment around the rest of the world desperately need cheap energy. Now, I know you think I'm absolutely out to lunch here. It isn't easy to be positive about this, but it only gets serious when you start to make these solutions really work in your own lives, in our communities, in our workplaces. Because solutions, very small solutions, empower people to go on to bigger solutions. And for me, that is where we are today. The side of the balance sheet that says, it's all up with the conventional system, we're in terrible trouble, it's doom and gloom from here to hell, basically, which I'm summarizing Jim's book, but that's sort of what it reads like, in case you just don't want to buy and just get the shortened version. No, I shouldn't encourage you. You do need to buy it as well, okay, but that's the short version. Instead of that line, what we increasingly need to do is to say, yes, these are frail, tentative solutions emerging in our midst, and the only way to make them substantive is to scale them to the point where they constitute a genuine revolution in the way that people live today. And then the final, utterly radical and mad thought, just imagine what would happen if that made people happier. I'm astonished. And doing the research for my book, I was actually, the thing that really depressed me, sorry I'm going back into the doom and gloom temporarily, but the thing that really depressed me wasn't so much the eco stuff, which I've lived with for 30 years. It was much more the data that I discovered about what is happening to the human spirit, about where we are going as an industrial, quote, civilization, quotes, about levels of ill ease, of mental stress, pathological behavior, addictive behavior, dysfunctionality, levels of mental disease and in ill health. Astonishing to see the evidence mapped out in front of you of the psychological and human costs of living the way we choose to live today. You may have seen a report published just 2 weeks ago by Professor Richard Layard, in which he'd done a calculation of the costs of stress and depression in the UK today. £17 billion. A figure made up of lost work time, lost productivity, days off, etc., etc., plus massive treatment costs to deal with these responses to the terrible world in which we live. So we've got to start talking about well-being, about contentment, about happiness, about ensuring that the key objective in any society is to make sure that more people are happier at the end of 1 year than they were at the start of it. Going back to Benthamite utilitarian notions that the greatest good is the greatest happiness of the greatest number. And the weird thing is that our politicians, for all their notional enthusiasm about making life better for us through economic growth, have completely lost the plot because they don't connect any longer with net levels of human contentment in society. They only connect with levels of growth generated, hopefully, to create that happiness. So I don't think we're short on the positives, but I do think we're short on the will to make those positives really work. And for me, however many minutes and hours and days you may spend worrying about climate change, peak oil, all the other apocalyptic things, in essence, the challenge now is to turn that analysis into an incredibly powerful representation of why people's lives would be so much better today as well as tomorrow. Right, so we still have 20 minutes or so for Q&A, so I've sort of rattled through that a million miles an hour, broken all the rules about speaking far too fast, etc., etc., got very hot in the process. Climate change is alive and well on this stage. I don't know what it's like for you down there, but... Right, and I'm told we do have some microphones. Indeed we do. People are even hotter than me because they're wearing yellow tabards. So... Now, there was an old adage when I went to do public meetings that you never took the first hand to go up because they were bound to be a representative of the Socialist Workers' Party. On this occasion, I happen to know that this is just a former president of the NFU, so that's almost as bad, but let's take the risk anyway.
Jonathan, I think you're hopelessly naive if you think you'd make any difference at all to Clarkson. If you flogged him your own personal carbon emissions. But indeed, very little has happened in terms of consumption, and the trend that you were talking about, well, we went to $100. If we'd gone to 70, Ryanair put on an extra 1 million passengers last year, and cheap travel is still very much with us and looks to go on growing, and may go on growing even at $100. You mentioned at the very end petitions. You've dealt with politicians and been frustrated by politicians, but on both sides of the Atlantic, and indeed most of Europe, politicians are not making a serious effort to sell this message. Do you really believe that we can resolve this problem until they can be persuaded to do so?
But it's kind of chicken and egg, isn't it? Because you know what politicians are like. They profess to being leaders in the public space. They sort of give you the impression they're there to lead the country, or possibly just lead their party, or lead a peculiar life in John Prescott's case. Whatever it might be, they're there to kind of be leaders. But the truth of it is, and you know this, politicians are not really there to do that. These days, they're really there to find out what it is that people think they want, and then do their best to meet that. It's what I call the Tescoization of politics. Because Tesco works on the simple rule, if we know what our customer wants, then we can make that work for our customer. And hey presto, they've become one of the most successful companies in the world. It's a slight shortcut to the real Tesco style of doing it, because don't forget, along the way, they tell their customers what they want as part of surfacing the public opinion. But there we are. Politicians don't really take these big leadership steps. They wait until they know it's safe to go out and try and get votes from people who will then be sympathetic, predisposed to the leadership that they then offer them. So am I optimistic about persuading our politicians? Well, I mean, 30 years into this journey, it's very difficult for me to draw on a deep well of optimism about politics. I mean, I can draw on a deep well of optimism about human nature and about what I know is possible, both technologically, in terms of social change, and for me, of course, in terms of this, what I call a metaphysical reconstruction of humankind's ambitions for this planet and its own future. I can draw on a huge, deep sense of optimism there, but I can't really draw on that well of optimism when it comes to politics, because I think that they will be dragged into this, actually. I just don't believe that we'll see them take the lead here. I'm really sorry about that. You know, if I did believe that, it would be a great deal easier, wouldn't it? One there? No.
Can you really address the problems that you've been talking about without any mention of the size of the human population?
Well, you can. I don't in my book.
If I overplug my book now, probably. I'm told three plugs is the acceptable limit, giving a talk like this. I don't underestimate it in my book. Indeed, I've made a point about stressing population throughout my life as an environmentalist, not least because it irks me so much that many environmentalists don't want to talk about population. And I am on the record very, very clearly as saying that the intensity of the problems that we face now is largely a function of the size of the human population. And however many people I will upset by saying that, I'm sorry, I don't care where you go to draw counterfactual insights about how population isn't really the issue, it's relative consumption, all the rest of it. Well, you know, stick with that if you really must. But the truth of it is, if we were trying to fashion a sustainable future for 1 billion people on planet Earth today, done deal. Not really particularly difficult, in all honesty. Not only that, we'd probably sort out poverty along the way. 6 billion? Whoa. That is a stretch. Because for me, you can't talk about this unless you talk about it for the whole of humankind. The idea that we can somehow withdraw into a sustainable gated community, as someone once described it, where we withdraw behind these walls and lead this life of astonishing, pristine, ecological simplicity, while the rest of the world just collapses around us, is well, morally repugnant and also insane. There's no wall high enough to keep out a people desperate enough to breach that wall. So 6 billion is a massive stretch. 9 billion, which is what the population will be in 2050, thereabouts, 8.75 if we're lucky, but roughly 9 billion, is just a massive problem, a massive problem. So it's not that I didn't want to bring in another rider of the apocalypse, as it were, but just today I thought we'd leave population to one side. But you're right, it is pretty critical, particularly when you look at what's happening in China. 1.3 billion people growing their economy at 9% per annum for 20 years. That changes the sustainability stakes to an astonishing degree. There was a lady down here, yes. And then I'll come over this side, sorry.
I have two things I want to ask you. Your happiness thing worries me. I think you'd have a hard time arguing that people before the first reform bill or before the First World War were happier than they are now. So I think there's no such thing as a happyometer. But if you could argue for a happyometer, I'd like to hear how that works. My other question is, you didn't talk about alternatives. Sustainable hydroelectric power only works in certain places and in certain circumstances. We now have huge dams being built in China and India, displacing people. People prefer dams to nuclear power. Wind power doesn't work, it's not efficient. What are the alternatives?
Yeah, I mean, when I talked about happiness, I very carefully did not say we should go back. I'm totally share your view. There's never been a golden age in humankind which we can refer back to and say, wouldn't it be wonderful to live like that. I don't know when that golden age came. I don't believe it came. So I have no truck with those who say we ought to go back to a simpler world, you know, less driven by technology and so on. But it's perfectly feasible to talk about contentment and happiness as a bigger driver in politics today than purely talking about economic growth. You may not believe him, but the fact that David Cameron is sort of testing the ground on the politics of well-being is very interesting. Not least because it's really irritating the hell out of the Labour Party, which is great. And, you know, somewhere along the line, this is going to happen. Eventually, when the inevitable becomes, absolutely unavoidable, people find a way of expressing that so that it becomes more desirable to people. And the politics of happiness will absolutely emerge in our midst through some political expression or another. Absolutely. It has to. Because you cannot go on promoting the politics of economic growth as a way of meeting people's aspirations. It just can't be done in physical terms. So I know it sounds funny and people are uncomfortable with the language about happiness. I prefer to use the language of well-being myself. There's a lot of academic work about what well-being looks like, a huge amount of data available about what it is that really makes people feel good about their lives, about feeling safe, about feeling fulfilled, feeling loved, feeling connected, able to get access to good, rewarding work, able to be part of a vibrant community, able to take time out, able to feel fulfilled in their less material aspirations.
all of these things are there as a complex matrix of what it is that make people feel good about themselves in their community, with their children, with thoughts of the future in mind. So I'm not at all apologetic about advancing deeper thinking about the politics of well-being, because I can tell you that is going to come. Sure as night follows day, that will come. On the alternatives, I didn't have a chance really to go into that. Actually, partly because I'm just not worried about it. I'm just not worried. I know that these alternatives are going to come. I spent 3 hours last week talking to a bunch of scientists, unbelievable people, who are doing some extraordinary work on trying to reproduce what it is that goes on through the process of photosynthesis. And take the incredible kind of chemical reactions that go on in photosynthesis, you know, day by day, everything. I mean, the world is built on green cells basically creating energy that we then take advantage of. Trying to find ways, understanding how plants, trees and other biomass convert sunshine into an energy form that then permits those organisms to thrive in the way that they do. How could you replicate that to turn it to human purpose? So I said, what do you think, is this for real? And he said, sure, this is for real. You know, we don't see any difficulty about this. People talk about fusion power in 40 years. We reckon we can crack this one in 6 or 7. I talk to people about photovoltaic cells. Jeremy Leggett talks about new technologies in photovoltaics. You'll see in The Guardian today a new wind turbine design. Look, in terms of the revolution, the technological revolution to generate energy alternatives, we're about 1% down the road. 1%. So by the time you bring in the extra 99%, that's a completely arbitrary figure, as you've obviously guessed, but don't worry about that. By the time we brought in the other 99%, our energy world won't look the way it looks today. We're just stuck in this mindset driven by central grids and filling stations. We're stuck. Our minds are blocked. We've got to get out of those mindsets into an energy world that is going to look so different. It is extremely difficult to think it through. So oddly enough, I'm really not worried about the technology, because I know what's going to happen when we start to get to work on proper solutions for supplying energy for 9 billion people. I just know what will happen.
I was interested that at the moment, apparently, in Britain, people are carrying more debt individually than at any other time before, which suggests that people have been convinced into buying into a lifestyle that basically they can't afford. And from some of what you're saying, it sounds like this lifestyle that we've been persuaded to try and buy is at some point going to completely outstrip the majority of the community in Britain to a point where they really, really can't afford it. So it makes me wonder whether some of the characters that you get on TV that can go into a household and start giving them some really good advice about how there's a lot of things they're buying that they really don't need, and lots of things, gadgets that they can switch off. Because it feels a bit like the Roaring Twenties, where there's this massive party going on at the moment that is really rather out of control,
yeah,
which includes things like very cheap flights, and at some point it needs to come to an end, and yet there's a lot of big companies and corporations out there that are making an awful lot of money out of our party habits,
yeah.
And I just wondered if you had any sort of insight into how we can encourage people to take another look at how they're living and see that there really is...
Well, indebtedness is a massive issue. And indeed, the work that Richard Layard did on depression and stress showed, I can't remember where it came in the pecking order, it was either number 2 or number 3, that personal debt is one of the principal drivers of unhappiness, stress, depression, and so on. And it is true that we're all caught up in what is, in effect, a big conspiracy. I mean, I'm very nervous about using conspiracy language, but there is a huge conspiracy going on, because in a way the government needs us to be out there consuming, flexing our credit cards, because that's what keeps the wheels of the economy lubricated. And if we weren't out there doing all of that stuff, many companies would face increased economic difficulties. There'd be less tax revenue coming in because the companies wouldn't be producing as much corporation tax, there wouldn't be as many people employed, there'd be less income tax, there'd be less value-added tax, so suddenly our revenue base would decline. And we're now stuck in a situation where in order to maintain public services and any kind of sense of security in people's lives, governments have to exhort their citizens to plunge themselves deeper and deeper into wholly unsustainable and, in my opinion, inhumane levels of personal debt. The entire global economy is built on this pyramid of debt. It's unbelievable when you deconstruct it. You go from personal debt through to corporate debt, farm debt, national debt, all the different kinds of debt, all the way through the system. And right at the top sits America, this astonishing indebted nation. America borrows $2 trillion a day. $2 trillion a day. And do you know why it can do that? It can do that because an agreement in 1940 compelled every country to buy oil in dollars. And because we all have to buy oil in dollars, we have to hold dollars as our reserve currency. We hold some gold, not so much these days, but we have to hold dollars as our reserve currency. And now I'll just give you an insight into a completely horrendous world that we're living in. There is a growing school of thought in America that the reason why we are likely to go to war with Iran is not just that we've got a madman in the White House, but that Iran is now threatening to create a new oil market which will trade oil in euros, not in dollars. And they've already won the support of China, India, Venezuela, and a number of other countries. And there is a very serious school of thought that says that if that were to happen, that the world economy would be plunged into the equivalent of economic Armageddon. And America just, the theory goes, isn't going to let that happen. So you're right to focus on debt. But look, what do you do about debt? You have to work your debt down. So this adage, live better by consuming less, which I know sounds so utterly insane, so deeply subversive, the idea that there is a political message out there that consists in persuading people not just to consume more responsibly, to consume more ethically, to consume more sustainably, in a more environmentally friendly way, to consume more locally, all of which, obviously, all of you are doing, all of which is stuff, of course, that the Gaia organization here is rightly exhorting people to do more and more of. But boy, you've got to be brave in today's political world to go out there and say, actually, the trick is to consume less. And why? Because you'll be happier. So debt's at the heart of this different vision of a more sustainable world. Absolutely at the heart of it. There's one at the back, in green. There's no guarantee, of course, but...
I think Lord Layard would approve a bit of cognitive reframing. Would it not be better to see the peak oil point not so much as a council of despair, but actually as the trigger to the solution? I don't think Jeremy Clarkson will be beaten by rhetoric, but the moment when oil is $100 a barrel and bioethanol from sugar beet can be produced for the equivalent of $90 a barrel, I'm pretty sure Jeremy will be in the queue to buy that. When wind and tidal power can be produced for $90 a barrel equivalent and oil is more expensive than that, those things will happen. The reason why we have 1% of renewable fuels is not because we can't do it, but because oil is too cheap. The market solution will provide the answer. The technologies will be there when we reach that happy point of peak oil.
I agree. I absolutely agree. And I mean, I know this is desperate stuff because, you know, people look at the peak oil moment as, you know, the worst thing waiting in the wings. But actually, it is precisely that galvanizing element that's missing at the moment to remind people that this was always, by definition, an unsustainable asset. We know that. By definition, it's unsustainable because there will come a time when it runs out. What we're debating about is when it runs out. So, you're right, but we haven't got into the mode of celebrating this yet. We're just seeing this as an end to everything that apparently we cherish and love to have more of.
So we don't just want the peak oil bunch to be out there saying, whoa, this is coming faster than you want. Oh, it's going to be really tough. We want them saying, yes, look, just around the corner of this magic moment is called the peak oil moment. And from then on, our lives are going to get better. Just smile, it'll help. Shall we just pass it down there, just down the end of the row? I think I can probably do two more very quickly. I'm sorry, we have to finish pretty promptly, I guess. And then we'll take one more on that side. That one there, in the middle, yeah.
Thank you. Jonathan, you talked about biomass, but you didn't say very much about trees. And I think trees can offer so much for so many people and do a great deal for the carbon business as well. Astonishingly, this government and the Forestry Commission has now allows only 3,000 hectares of trees planted per year, which is about a tenth of what it did 10 years ago.
Yeah.
It is quite astonishing. Trees can do so much to help stress, people, you know, walking amongst woodlands, and a tremendous lot on the carbon side. Can you do something about it and poke them a bit?
Yes, sir. Happily. Actually, you've touched on a really interesting point there, which I will just deviate to for 30 seconds, which is the notion of trees, woodlands, forests as healing presences in our lives, as part of the therapeutic process that we now need to engage in. I've just seen a beautiful bit of research, which is just fantastic. Unlike Richard Layard, who actually, his answer to this depression is to appoint more councillors. Okay. Very good for GDP, of course, because lots more councillors taking lots more fees and all the rest of it. I don't go with Richard Lay on that. My answer to depression is prescribing exercises to do with the natural world, engagement with the natural world. Now, that will sound odd to you, but the British Trust for Conservation Volunteers, which has a wonderful thing called Green Gyms, has proved that if you can persuade GPs to prescribe participation in local conservation projects, whether it's building dry stone walls or going out into trees and doing low-level management, whatever it might be, that the effect is dramatically accelerated, so the therapy rate, the healing rate, is much faster than conventional drug-based therapies. And not only that, you get it at a 30th of the cost of conventional mental health, depression, drug-based remedies. A 30th. This is a government that's meant to be concerned about cost-effectiveness. Now, this is a serious piece of work, and I invite you all to think about this without saying, he is really quite mad, isn't he, actually? He is right at the end there. He was kind of about to go out and tell us all to go and hug a tree. We could tell, you know, he may be the government's advisor on sustainable development, but actually, he's pretty dodgy, really. You go and look at the data on that. It is astonishing. And why? Because deep in each and every one of us is this need to be connected with the natural world, with that surge of energy in the natural world, which we are still absolutely dependent on, intricately connected to. It's what E.O. Wilson describes as biophilia, this love of life, of living, which is in us, however mad, industrialized, dehumanized lives we actually lead at the moment. Very, very inspiring. But have a bit of evidence. You know, this government, you have to have evidence. Right, this has to be the last one. I'm really sorry. Otherwise, I'd be in terrible trouble. If I got my red light now. Okay, I've got the message. Yes?
I suppose that the question I'm just about to ask will ultimately just be a yes or no question. I'm really glad that in your speech you referred to human nature or the human spirit, because I think that ultimately of all of the topics that you've referred to, that spirit is what fuels it all. That, I suppose, you also refer to the connection to nature as well. Out of everything you said to do with what drives the moral issue, which then in turn drives our desire for consumerism, for example, do you ultimately believe that, having said everything you've said today to us in this room, and having written your book, which I don't know how many people will read, I hope it's a lot, do you think that ultimately, irrespective of all that's said and just what's done, things will change? Do you think that humans will turn around and become moral as we so insistently are not today?
What did you describe that as? A yes or no question? That's a yes or no question. Boy, I'm in the wrong place. Well, you can imagine I spend a lot of time, I do spend a lot of time worrying about that very question. And I was being a bit mean about Jim, but, you know, Jim's book really upset me personally, really, really upset me, because I get very stuck when I find someone telling me that actually I'm, you know, we're just completely irrelevant to making any difference to the way the world works. Stuck spiritually as well as stuck politically and economically. It just goes right down deep into my guts as such a disempowering thing. So do I think we are going to end up in the right place? The answer to that question is absolutely, emphatically yes. I really, truly do believe that. I spent 10 years as a teacher in a London comprehensive school. This is how to test your theories of human nature more than anything else, okay? It was a tough school in the White City, you know, Wormwood Scrubs. It was tough, but it was an incredible, incredible experience. And after 10 wonderful years, I came out absolutely convinced that in a place where, in a way, it's astonishing that the goodness in human beings is somehow nurtured and sustained and shines through despite levels of desperate deprivation, material and psychological, let alone spiritual deprivation. If that is still there, then the potential for that element, for that goodness in human nature to triumph over those less desirable aspects of human nature, for me, was confirmed through that experience. And I've held to that ever since. So I'm absolutely certain we'll get to the right place. But I'm also very worried that we won't get there unless we begin to accelerate the change processes that are necessary. And part of that change process is a deeper resonance around values-based issues, for me, spiritual issues, a reconnection at that plane, at that level, as well as a lot of very hard work on the science, the economics, and the politics. This is part of what I think the future is. Thank you.